The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hey, it's The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 21st, 2016. If you like our interview with Glennon Doyle Melton about affairs later in the show, you can check out thetakeaway.org for a longer interview with Glennon, plus more. Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Honesty and history, truth and reconciliation, that's our focus this hour. Whether it's on a stage as small as between two people who share wedding vows, as large as a nation of more than 300 million people, or local communities of thousands, hundreds, even dozens of people trying to find ways of coming together to overcome the forces keeping them apart. Sound from Charlotte, North Carolina, last night. Protests after a black man was killed in a police shooting. Police said the man named Keith Lamont Scott had a gun. Here's the scene in Tulsa yesterday.
Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up, don't shoot! Hands up!
Protesters outside Tulsa's courthouse protesting last Friday's police shooting of an unarmed 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher after his vehicle broke down on his way home from class at Tulsa Community College. These incidents are alarming and familiar, but in the case of Tulsa, Oklahoma, the shooting of Terrence Crutcher cannot be separated from the echoes of an incident back in 1921, a race riot over 3 days which killed 300 people in a violent battle between whites and blacks that has few, if any, equivalents in American history. The Department of Justice and Oklahoma State authorities, by the way, have launched investigations into the current Tulsa shooting. Michelle Brown is the program coordinator at the Greenwood Cultural Center in Tulsa. She says there's no forgetting in Tulsa.
The racism that existed here during the race riot that, in fact, led to the race riot still exists. It is an inherited racism that has been passed down from generation to generation that has never truly been addressed. And while we see and hear people making racist comments and acting in a racist manner, when they are confronted about that racism, they deny being racist at all. So you can't address it or handle it, deal with it, if you're not even willing to admit that it exists.
So there's an honesty about history that Tulsa has failed to embrace, to deal with what happened in 1921 when 300 people were killed. The neighborhood in Greenwood, where you live, is that right?
Yes.
Was destroyed, looked like Aleppo in Syria. And now all that's washed over. And people in Tulsa, you could move into Tulsa tomorrow and never have any hint that that took place in 1921.
That's absolutely correct. If you were not to visit the Greenwood Cultural Center, where there are actually exhibits, you would not necessarily hear about it. And it's only been recently within the last year or so where they made it mandatory that it be taught in the public high schools in the history classes. However, they have a lot of leniency as to how much they talk about it. And many of the textbooks talk very little about or mention very little about the Tulsa race riot or Black Wall Street. There's always been an effort, and we've been talking about it for a little over 20 years. And there's always been an effort by people here to sweep it under the rug.
Michelle Brown, is the Holocaust taught in Tulsa public schools, the Diary of Anne Frank and that?
Yes.
Yeah. And work of Elie Wiesel, who says never forget in thinking about the Holocaust?
Yes.
And so why is it never forget with something like the Holocaust that happened, in Europe to a certain extent? I mean, even though it involved lots and lots of people spread all over the world, how come the message is never forget there? And in an incident that happened in Tulsa in 1921, it's, oh, we need to move forward. We need to leave that in the past. That forgetting is the healthy thing to do, it seems, as though certain people say. What do you say to that?
When we were attending Black history classes during my youth, we talked about slavery. We talked about the civil rights era, and they never mentioned the events of the Tulsa race riot or Black Wall Street. And I think that there's definitely some reluctance to talk about a history that people know that their ancestors, that their relatives may have been and could have been involved in. We still have two living race riot survivors. We identified 165 survivors in 1996. And some of the people that were here shooting and killing innocent, unarmed men and women were children. They were some of them were children of Ku Klux Klan members who had been armed and brought to Greenwood and given permission to kill innocent people and knew that there would be no repercussion. So people don't want to acknowledge this part of our history. They don't want to talk about it because they know that they could have direct relatives that were involved in the killing and murdering of innocent, unarmed people here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
All right, Michelle, how do you think that history and the knowledge of what you're describing that took place almost 100 years ago can help in the community dealing with the killing of Terrence Crutcher, who was unarmed and was shot during a traffic stop?
I think that what's so troubling and frustrating for us as a people today is that we are still dealing with that same racism that is still evident in our police department as it was in 1921, because there were police officers that were participating in the riot. But it helps us to understand who we are and where we come from and what we're able to overcome as a people.
Michelle Brown is the program coordinator at the Greenwood Cultural Center in Tulsa, which explores the history of the race riot in 1921 that killed 300 people and ravaged the neighborhood of Greenwood. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So ask a young dad in America what's the most alarming question his children have ever asked him about what's going on in the world around them.
It's so hard to not feel like it never will end day after day. You know, Tyree King, Terrence Crutcher, Keith Lamont Scott. It's just, it feels like it never will end.
Jeff Chang's new book, We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation, is a series of essays that struggles to understand why America seems to go backwards in the pursuit of racial justice, even as it has moments of clarity. Is Jeff Chang optimistic? What do you think?
Some places segregation never ended, but in a lot of ways, the narrative is about retrenchment, about going back, in other words, 50 years. The last national consensus we had for racial justice was in 1965. And since that time, what we've seen is sort of a rise and fall of desegregation efforts. So I'm not just talking about housing. I'm talking about schooling. I'm talking about all the indices that we can see in terms of health, wealth, income, obviously incarceration. Of course, the key policing and extrajudicial murders of black people, which have spawned the movement for black rights and now drawn us back into this moment where most Americans feel concerned about race relations, you know, for the first time since 1992 and before that, 1965.
You love history.
I do.
I'm a geek.
I'm a nerd for it.
It's all over this book.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if we look back in history, this is the American pattern. Centuries of slavery, the Civil War, an enormous slaughter, then a emancipation, that's over, then decades of terrorism and death on racial terms meted out by whites against blacks in the Jim Crow period.
Yeah. Then, after a period of Reconstruction.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
A moment, an eye blink of Reconstruction.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the Civil Rights Movement, an eye blink of reconciliation, let's call it. And then poof, when that's done, decades until the present moment of quietly, you know, I think we all would rather live by ourselves. What's not being addressed, do you think, in America that we have these episodes of little peaks and then lots of valley?
Yeah, I call it the cycle of crisis, the crisis cycle. There's sort of a backlash. There's an action. There's a crisis. There's a reaction. There's a backlash that comes in. And then there's a sense of complacency and a sense of exhaustion that sets in. And so we had this little moment, right? Maybe the month before Barack Obama was elected, to January 1st when Oscar Grant's killed by a policeman in Oakland, California, that can be called the post-racial period, right? In which there's optimism, there's sort of exuberance, there's a feeling that we're actually moving forward. But I definitely feel as if it has to do with us not wanting to look at what it is that we do around this, not wanting to resolve the underlying questions of racial justice. I'm somebody who believes very strongly in the culture as the place to help us figure out how to move things forward.
So ignore the national election?
No, not
ignore
at all.
Donald Trump?
No,
ignore the silliness of the rhetoric?
No, not at all. I'm saying, you know, to work in communities is what inspires me, to see people coming together in communities trying to figure this out on a personal level, on a one-to-one type of level, and that during periods where the politics of the situation feels untenable, it feels like completely stalemated, it doesn't feel like anything can actually pass. That's why we have to be able to have cultural interventions to be able to continue to help us think and dream about what we can move towards.
But people say the election is about not thinking. The election is about fear. The election is about...
It is. And, I think, well, I think...
And that's a sign that we're going backwards.
I think that's absolutely the case. I think that those are the dominant forces, but I think that the forces of folks who are interested in the good can see this as a moment to be able to organize and be able to move things forward. We see housing segregation as gentrification. We see school segregation as the achievement gap. And these are absolutely good frames, and they help to tell us what is a part of what's going on. But if we talk about gentrification, we're missing all the people who get displaced, who moved to suburbs like Ferguson or Sanford, Florida, where Trayvon Martin was killed, right? If we talk about school segregation in terms of the achievement gap, we're missing what's been happening with the increasing racial isolation of different groups, whites on the one hand, and then blacks and Latinos on the other hand. And so we've got to be able to see this as something that, as it did in the 60s, forced us to be able to address these questions as something that's really, really critical as we move forward to becoming a majority-minority country.
You got kids?
I do, and this is
what do they ask? What do they ask?
What are right?
What's the most hopeful question your kids asked? What's the most alarming question your kids have asked?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think the most alarming question that they have is, you know, will this ever end? Which is, I think, it's so hard to not feel like it never will end day after day. You know, Tyree King, Terrence Crutcher, Keith Lamont Scott, it feels like it never will end. But what I think gives me hope is the fact that they're able to form these deep connections and friendships and relationships, look out for each other in ways that maybe, you know, some of us in the older generation never were able to.
Author, artist Jeff Chang. The title of the book is
We Gonna Be All Right.
From Your Mouth to God's Ears, buddy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here are some of your reactions to the shooting of Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma on our Facebook page. Ted writes, anyone who sees the video where he is gunned down with both of his hands up walking slowly backwards can see plain as day he was no threat and killed by a trigger-happy officer, period. End of story. Tyra wrote, what is known is very little. How about instead of inflaming what little is known, we wait and find out the facts, then form our opinions. Comment, continue the conversation at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
31 trucks, 9 tons of medicine and clothing for 78,000 people, tons more food. An aid convoy bound for Aleppo, Syria, was reportedly hit from the air this week. 20 civilians were killed in the attack. Most of the aid was destroyed. The United Nations has suspended aid shipments, it is said. A ceasefire negotiated last week is barely a memory. And the U.S. is now accusing Russia and Syria of attacking that U.N. Red Crescent convoy. Both Russia and Syria deny it.
The humanitarians delivering life-saving aid were heroes. Those who bombed them were cowards.
That's United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking about the events in Syria this week. What's it like to be a part of the humanitarian mission in Syria and to be deliberately targeted by military forces? Shadi Martini is a former hospital administrator from Aleppo who now works with Syrian refugees right here in the United States. He says he knows what it's like to be used as a weapon in an endless war.
It was very dangerous, very risky, and it was one of the riskiest professions out there. And, you know, to work in a hospital, that was very risky.
And now we learn to deliver international aid is also very risky. The 31 trucks destroyed from the air on their way into Aleppo to try to get food in there. Why are humanitarian aid workers the target right now?
Well, because they are easy to target. But this didn't stop planes from coming and bombing it. And according to U.S. officials, it was two Russian planes that did it.
We've evolved from a point where an event like this would be reacted to with apologies and, oh, that was a mistake, and, oh, it wasn't us. And we're seeing some of that this week. But there's also a sense that these kinds of attacks produce a particular demoralization among the population inside Aleppo, that you can fight and drop bombs, and that's one thing. But if you target the people trying to save you with international food and medical aid, you're really striking at the heart of any sense of hope.
Yes, exactly. This is the aim. You know,
it's a new weapon.
Well, yeah, it's a strategy. You see it on hospitals. You know, if you look at a website for instance for an organization that is monitoring this, Physicians for Human Rights, you can see that targeting of medical facilities is intentional and have increased in the last 2 to 3 years. I remember 2 months ago we had the targeting of all hospitals in Aleppo, and that made a lot of doctors flee, and you had very few doctors staying inside the city. That's a way of trying to win the war, by destroying all the civilian structure of your opponent, and this way you will make it very hard for civilians and any population to continue to live in this area, and you try to win the war by this.
I've heard that some doctors would leave the hospital and find places that they could make secret operating rooms using flashlights and equipment that they would smuggle into these basement operating rooms to try to save people and get away from the fighting. Have you heard such stories?
Well, we've done such things, but that was very early on in 2012 and 2013, when a lot of these operations were did in government-controlled areas. The government didn't allow people who got shot in demonstrations or beaten to get treatment, so a lot of doctors were forced to do this. Later on, when it's more a military conflict, it's more going underground. So you have a lot of doctors going underground, either in cellars, basements, and sometimes digging holes in caves, going into caves and trying to do their work, because it's safer from bombing. And, of course, very few doctors are left to do this dangerous work because of the continuous bombing, aerial bombardment, especially by the Russian forces and the Syrian government forces, who have conducted like 95% of these attacks. It's very hard to operate.
What are you doing today in Michigan? How are you doing with refugees? And what do you make of the discussion of immigrants and refugees in the United States?
It's a very tough discussion. You know, people have a lot of anxieties, especially when you have a political season. You have economic anxiety. You have security anxieties with the terrorist attacks conducted by, you know, supporters of ISIS. So we try to explain to people what refugees really are. They are people who are fled their homes because of war. Most of the time, they are normal people. They are highly educated. They are being vetted very thoroughly, and Syrian refugees especially are being vetted, you know, on a higher level than any other refugees. And the data actually doesn't support that Syrian refugees are a danger to security, which is the biggest fear at the moment.
Do you know what Skittles are?
I know what Skittles are. Yes, my son loves Skittles.
Right. So you heard this story about, dealing with the refugee situation in the United States is like imagining a bowl of Skittles where a couple of them are, you know, poisonous. And this is a message from a member of the Trump family. How does that make you feel?
Yes, I've heard about it. I've heard about it. I've heard about Peanuts, I think, several months ago, a year ago, also comparing refugees to poisonous peanuts. It's sad. It's sad that we are comparing human beings that are fleeing tragedy. War is, you know, once I was in Europe and we were helping refugees, and at the same time, a close by town was flooded. So a lot of refugees volunteered and we went and helped the flooded victims. And they told us, how come you're coming refugees from Syria and you're helping us? We said, we feel your pain. You know, you lost your home, you lost all your belongings. So it's like something that happened to us. So I just tell him, you know, it could happen to you. It could happen to anyone. Please be so more compassionate. Have a heart. Just have a heart.
Shadi Martini is a former hospital administrator from Aleppo, Syria, now a refugee and senior Syria advisor for Multiphase Alliance for Syrian Refugees in Michigan. He spoke to us from Southfield, a suburb of Detroit. Thank you so much, Shadi.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
You might say there was a line in front of the Wells Fargo teller window yesterday.
I want to make very clear that we never directed nor wanted our team members to provide products and services to customers that they did not want. That said, I accept full responsibility for all unethical sales practices in our retail banking business.
On Capitol Hill, that's Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf testifying in front of a hearing of the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, where Republicans and Democrats were all lining up to take a shot.
I've been on this committee for nearly 10 years now. You have done something that has never happened in the last 10 years and united this committee on a major topic, and not in a good way.
Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf being excoriated by Democrat John Tester over revelations that Wells Fargo created almost 2 million fake accounts open for customers without their permission.
Why isn't this crystal clear proof that an entity as big as Wells is not only too big to fail, but it's too big to manage and it's too big to regulate? 1% of a big part of your business is fired over fraud, but that doesn't rise to your level.
Yeah, and Senator, that's a good question. I've thought about that. This was a problem of focus.
Stump was forced to focus on how consumers were billed for millions in fees, like a fee for not maintaining a minimum balance. How could you? On an account you know nothing about. The bank has since been fined a total of $185 million and has fired at least 5,300 employees. The money is a pittance compared to Wells Fargo's stock value, which CEO Stump noted. A rhetorical investment which only earned him the blue-faced rage of Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Okay, so you haven't resigned, you haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings, you haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees who don't have the money for a fancy PR firm to defend themselves. It's gutless leadership.
CEO Stump took responsibility and tried to say that his bank did not have a culture of compelling retail employees to commit fraud to meet financial targets. Stump said his employees were paid good money, at which point New Jersey Senator and Democrat Bob Menendez stepped up.
I know that in response to Senator Brown's question as what is an average banker at Wells Fargo made, you said between $30,000 and $60,000. You said that's good money. How much money did you make last year?
$19.3 million.
Now that's good money. Now that's good money.
Alexis Goldstein is senior policy analyst for Americans for Financial Reform. Alexis, this is all good fun, but help us to understand seriously what the importance of these hearings are and where we might go from here.
I think this raises important questions. As Senator Vitter said in the clip that you played, are these some of these banks still too big to manage? If the CEO, John Stumpf, is telling the truth and saying he didn't know about this, well, then that means that maybe there's just too many employees for him to oversee. That's one explanation. Another explanation is that they knew that this was happening and they looked the other way. In either case, I think we still have a situation where these banks are so big they either can't be managed effectively or they can't be regulated. So I think it creates a lot of questions moving forward.
Referencing Republican Senator David Vitter, there's also Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren we heard from there, Bob Menendez, a Democrat. There's partisan unity here, it seems. But do you think the Senate really has a will to make significant change here? Is this a sign of the success of accountability on Capitol Hill, or did something get by the changes that were supposed to have been made in 2009?
I think that we still have a problem with these banks being so unaccountable and so large. It remains to be seen, for example, if John Stumpf is going to lose his job or not. I should say, though, that there are things that the regulators could do now to try to prevent some of this from happening in the future. And a lot of that is because of the changes that we made in the wake of the crisis.
I can't resist playing this from Senator Sherrod Brown questioning John Stumpf. Listen.
Over the past 10 years, your bank has had approximately 39 enforcement actions, just a few of which have come up today. Many related to failure to serve or abusive conduct towards customers and investors. You talk much about Wells' culture, how proud you are of it and its ethics. What does this say? If you've had 39 enforcement actions, what does this say about Wells' culture and compliance programs?
We have more work to do.
Alexis Goldstein, more work to do. Is that the bank or Congress that has more work to do here, or both?
I think it's absolutely both. I think also there's more work to be done from the regulators. One of the things that came up in the hearing over and over again is the executive who oversaw all these abuses, an executive by the name of Carrie Tolstead, is walking away with nearly $125 million in compensation as she retires. She's being allowed to retire. She is not being fired. And one of the things the regulators can do is they're writing rules right now to govern how compensation happens in these large firms. And they could strengthen the rules and say, listen, if you get slapped with a huge fine like this, if you're found to be doing illegal things, you have to claw back and take back any huge pay packages for executives that oversaw this. You have to bring back the big bonuses for the CEOs. So we have an opportunity that doesn't even need to go through Congress, which, as we all know, is a very difficult thing to do right now. But absolutely, I think there needs to be real changes as Wells Fargo, John Stumpf should seriously think about at least giving back some of his bonus money.
Alexis Goldstein reminding us that there aren't a lot of precedents for what's happened at Wells Fargo and the accountability that there would need to be to prevent it from happening again. Alexis Goldstein, senior policy analyst for Americans for Financial Reform. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
A sad story of love, celebrity, and apparent dishonesty ends in a divorce for the celebrity couple Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, who've been through a well-publicized cancer scare, the total loss of privacy as parents raising six kids. The romantic details of Pitt and Jolie's breakup are hidden by publicists and the curtains of superstardom. But for wife and mom Glennon Doyle Melton, it's the sharing of all her bad choices and romantic troubles that has been both therapeutic and made her new book, Love Warrior, a number one bestseller.
I had just stopped drinking after 15 years of addiction. He clearly had all of this secret stuff going on forever. We were a mess, right?
Love Warrior tells of struggles with alcohol addiction, battles with bulimia, and her husband Craig's consumption of porn and affairs with women throughout their marriage. Melton has used her very turbulent personal life to launch herself into a newfound celebrity. Melton finds herself the confessional touchstone for millions of people struggling to save their marriages.
I started writing about my personal life and like the real raw stuff about recovering from addiction. And it helped me so much. You know, like they say, you're only as sick as your secrets, and kind of living all of the messy stuff out loud helped me stay sober and get strong. And so I kind of, when all this marriage stuff happened, I thought maybe the same thing is true of relationships. Like maybe if we talked more about the hard stuff and the messy stuff, it would help heal our marriages. And I think that's kind of what's happened. Like just getting it all out there has made people feel free to talk about the struggles that they have. Because marriage is hard for everybody. There is no shiny, perfect marriage, really. I mean, relationships are tough.
There's an interesting technological story here in that the computer is a mechanism for people to explore pornography, as your husband Craig did, and also apparently link up with other women, as your husband Craig apparently did. But it's also the window through which you're able to get all these honest feelings out. Can you comment on whether this would even have been possible in another era?
God, no. I mean, I think it's interesting, right? It's like Craig was looking for physical intimacy online and I was finding emotional intimacy online. We were both doing it outside of our marriage, right? It's just like an interesting parallel.
That is interesting, yeah. That's a great way of putting it. I mean, it's sort of the, men are from Mars, women are from Venus kind of idea that you're seeking the emotional piece online and he's seeking something very physical.
Right. And it goes back to we were missing each other, right? Like I was reaching out to him for a while to connect with me emotionally. It wasn't happening. So I turned to strangers. And it's interesting to think that he did the same thing on the other side. No, I mean, I think there's amazing things that come of this whole way of living on the internet. I mean, my blog, Momastery, has turned into Together Rising, which is a nonprofit that has raised $4 million online for women and children all over the world just through this blog community. So there are certainly amazing things that can happen when it's done well and right. But you certainly do have to be careful.
Do you think that your story is an example of or a lesson of you really should fight for your marriage if possible and that people give up too soon or don't waste your life in something that eventually isn't going to work out? What's the verdict on marriage from your experience?
I don't know. Look, I have no idea. I would never in a million years guess like what the lesson is or tell people what to do with their marriages. I mean, I will tell you that I come from a faith community and there's a lot of confusing messages there about marriage. I mean, people told me crazy stuff about what would happen to me if I didn't stay or,
like
you know, everybody
like
has
what?
Their
like
opinion.
What crazy
oh, God.
Stuff?
I mean, some woman came up to me in church and said, right at the height of it, and said, Glennon, you know that God hates divorce and you were put here to be Craig's helper. And I didn't go to church for like months and months. And yeah, it's just such, I mean, my God, the messages that women get in church about what, like there are churches who really try to convince women that leaving a man and leaving God are the same thing.
The irony here is that those are crazy remarks, but the virtues of struggling and the way that it brings you to a deeper place is worthwhile. That's worth doing.
That's what we did. But here's the deal. Like when I look back and think of like what that did for me and what that did for Craig is that we had that horrible situation and we both stayed in our pain and fought, right? We didn't run. We didn't run from each other. We worked our butts off for 4 years. But what happened is that he went into his own healing place and I went into my own healing place. So we both understood that this horrible situation was an opportunity for each of us to become stronger, wholer human beings. And we did. So I don't know if the lesson is to fight for your marriage, but I know that whatever crappy thing happens to us is an opportunity to fight to become wholer. Like I didn't say, oh my God, I'm going to save my marriage. I never said that. I just knew from being an addict and from all the other things I've recovered from that whatever happens to us in our life is an invitation just to get better. Somebody said, like, how does it feel that your marriage failed after all of that? And I just started laughing because I don't even relate to that at all. Like, mm-hmm. I can't even, John, I can't even put my head around considering the fact that my marriage was a failure. I cannot imagine anything being more successful than my marriage was because when Craig and I met, we were both broken people. I had just stopped drinking after 15 years of addiction. He clearly had all of this secret stuff going on forever. We were a mess, right? And we came together and for 14 years, we're just, it was hard as hell, but we were healing partners for each other. Mm. I needed his crap for whatever reason, and he needed my crap in order to face what we needed to heal in ourselves. And now we leave each other whole people. I mean, we love each other. He lives seven houses down from me now. We are able to get along better than we did when we were together. We're better. So I feel like my marriage was a raging success.
What advice would you give people who are looking for a couple's therapist? How can you go wrong? And, you know, what do you need to look out for?
I mean, I just think that everyone needs to learn to trust their instincts, right? I mean, I sat with that therapist and I knew in the first 10 minutes that he was off. And so when you know that, you just need to leave, because a good therapist can save your life and a bad therapist can ruin your life.
So are you, like, concerned about taking a step into a new life, or is it seem
John,
completely
do you
natural?
Know the truth about that?
Yes.
I'm so excited.
All right.
I'm excited, and I feel like I learned enough to begin again. And so's Craig. No, I'm super excited. I feel like every time you burn your life down, the next life is better.
Glennon Doyle Melton, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And she's the author of Love Warrior. Congratulations on all your success.
Thank you so much, John.
Angie and I, we're working together every day, I guarantee you.
We have this line of what we can do having six children, where if it can break us, that's okay, but if it can kill us, we kind of can't do it.
She's the best sounding board I have, and I value her opinion immensely.
I have a very even partner right now, and I think we're very balanced at home with our power sharing.
This is The Takeaway, and we're asking you to relate to the Brangelina affair with some turbulent home life stories of your own.
I've been with my husband for 15 years, and he's cheated on me in one form or another at least six times that I know of. But we have a great marriage other than that, so I stay. But sometimes I feel foolish for staying. I took my vow very seriously, and he's a really great dad, and our only real problem in our marriage is his infidelity and my inability to match his sex drive. And being disrespected and cheated on makes my sex drive even lower, so it's a vicious cycle.
Hi, this is Jack from Council Bluffs. Yes. I had an affair during my first marriage, and that affair led to divorce from my first wife. I got remarried, and my second wife had an affair, and that led to our divorce. I learned, seeing from both sides, that an affair is never a good thing.
Jane Phillips from Omaha, Nebraska. No and no. Pleasantly, my spouse and I have been married for almost 35 years. I assume that we've worn personality grooves into one another so that no one else wants us.
Yes, I was cheated on, but it had a happy ending. My wife was in Rome working on her dissertation, and I tell you which Renaissance sculptor she was writing about, but it would give away who she is. Anyway, I was paying 1 million lira a month for an apartment for her, and the budget was tight. She asked me to fly out to see her about 3 weeks after my last trip there, and it was the first time I ever said no to anything she asked for. Turns out my saying no led her to find someone who would say yes. She found a nice rich doctoral student from another Ivy League school at the Biblioteca Herziana in Rome. She called me a short time later and said she wasn't coming home, and I said, you're going to have to find another apartment. She got married to the guy, and I married someone else, and it was the single best thing that ever happened to me.
I've been the daughter of a man who cheated on my mom, the wife of a man who cheated on me, and the girlfriend of a man who was cheating on his wife. I didn't know he was still married when we met, but I believed him that he would leave her, and he didn't. My first question to any new prospect is, are you married? And if they are, and if 10 of them are, the conversation is over, no matter what the excuse is.
I had an affair for about 2 years. It began while my boyfriend and I were broken up, and we reconciled a few months later, but at that point I was in love with two different men and didn't know how to handle it. So bad choices happen sometimes.
Hi, this is Marnin from Medford, Massachusetts. I define cheating as breaking whatever relationship agreements you made with your partners. Note, however, that not cheating doesn't imply monogamy or exclusivity. I'm in a set of polyamorous relationships. Since we are not breaking those agreements, we are not cheating, even though it's in a non-monogamous setting.
You can share the same kind of honesty you heard from Glennon Doyle Melton by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can listen to our full interview with Melton at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.